The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions. Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneeweiss, and this is the Stoic Jew podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. Before we read from our Stoic readings today, I thought it would be a good idea to give you some background information about the context. So I'm currently recording this on Monday, August 8th, 2022, at around 4:45 p.m., This is the 11th of Av, and I'm currently 45-ish hours into my 48-hour fast. Now, you might be wondering, why are you fasting for 48 hours? So for more information on that, I will refer you to my one-page article that I wrote last year when I did a 48-hour fast in the show notes. The article I wrote entitled My Experience Fasting for 48 Hours on the 9th and 10th of Av. That experience of fasting did have a halakhic component, which has to do with the kiyum, the halakhic fulfillment of extending your fast from the 9th of Av into the 10th of Av. This year, that didn't apply because Tisha B'Av was pushed off. We're not going to go into the halakhic dimension. I want to focus on the experience here. Okay, so if you're interested in the halakhic dimension, then check out that one-page article. Factually speaking, I fasted for the full 25 hours of no eating and drinking on Tisha B'Av itself, or I guess on the 10th of Av, starting on Saturday night until Sunday night. And then on Sunday night, when everyone else broke their fast, I just had water, and I've continued to only consume things with no calories. So water, coffee, tea, etc. And I plan to do this until 8:15 tonight when I break my fast. Okay, so that's the experience. And because this was on my mind, I wanted to talk about it and just explore a couple of ideas. And if this is at all scattered, let's just blame it on the fast. I mean, I feel pretty clear-headed, but I'm also a little tired. So fasting does take some stuff out of you. So, all right. So I guess let's start off with something that we've read and talked about before, which is Seneca's an excerpt from Seneca's letter number 18 on feasting and fasting. Okay, and I'm just going to read a short excerpt here. He says, so this is his advice. He says, set aside a certain number of days during which you will be content with the scantiest and cheapest of fare, F-A-R-E, with coarse and rough dress, saying to yourself all the while, is this the condition that I feared? It is precisely in times of immunity from care that the soul should toughen itself beforehand for occasions of greater stress, and it is while fortune is kind that it should fortify itself against her violence. In days of peace, the soldier performs maneuvers, throws up earthworks with no enemy in sight, and wearies himself by gratuitous toil in order that he may be equal to unavoidable toil. If you would not have a man flinch when the crisis comes, train him before it comes. Such is the course which those men have followed, who, in their imitation of poverty, have every month come almost to want, that they might never recoil from what they had so often rehearsed. You need not suppose that I mean meals like Timon's or pauper's huts or any other device which luxurious millionaires use to beguile the tedium of their lives. Let the palate be a real one and the coarse cloak. Let the bread be hard and grimy. Endure all this for 3 or 4 days at a time, sometimes for more, so that it may be a test of yourself instead of a mere hobby. That's a funny Freudian slip. I said taste. Okay. Then I assure you, my dear Lucilius, you will leap for joy when filled with a pennyworth of food, and you will understand that a man's peace of mind does not depend upon fortune, for even when angry, she grants enough for our needs. Okay, so I've read this and talked about this a lot. I will try to link the episodes in the show notes where I talk about the main ideas. I want to focus on one specific thing here. Let me go over the basic idea. The basic idea is that there are a lot of conditions that we fear, and because we fear them, we avoid them at all costs. So one of those situations is starvation or hunger, really. I shouldn't even use the term starvation. Most of us, I'm sure, who are listening to this podcast have never been in a situation of real life starvation where our lives are in danger. But we tend to fear hunger as if it were starvation. I mean, that is kind of programmed into our biology. When you don't eat for a long time, then the survival mechanism kicks in and you feel like I have to find food at all costs. But, you look at the way that a lot of people behave, we Jews are accustomed to fasting. And you look at the way that a lot of Jews get towards the end of a fast, and especially when the fast is over, you know, that they're frantic about the food. And, you know, Rabbi Moskowitz, Olav Shalom, used to say that, you know, the real perfection of a fast doesn't come during the fast. It comes after the fast, when you get a window into your psyche to see how you relate to food. You know, are you scrambling to gorge yourself with food, you know, as if like, as if you're going to die if you don't get this food, or as if your life depends on the pleasure, or are you going to go about it in a way that is, you know, with moderation and self-control? So what was I going to say? Oh yeah. So that's the way that Jews who are accustomed to fasting relate to fast. But we were talking about fasting on Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, while we were fasting, we were talking about fasting. And someone mentioned that, like, a lot of non-Jews who never... Actually, it was my brother, Johnny. He was talking about how he was, you know, Johnny's a world traveler. He was, I forgot where he was. He was in some foreign country, and part of the tour involved serving, you know, they served the people on the tour lunch. And of course, Johnny couldn't eat it because it wasn't kosher. And so he got into a conversation with the non-Jews there about kashrus. And, you know, he said they were in awe of the fact that he could sit there while everyone else is eating and he's not going to eat. Like, don't you feel like you need to eat? And then somehow they got onto the topic of fasting, and like, they could not believe that he would voluntarily deprive himself of food for a whole day. And then he mentioned that in a Jewish fast, we don't even drink fluids. We don't drink water. And that just blew them away. You know, and we were talking about this, and someone else mentioned that, like, you know, as part of certain military training programs, then, you know, they'll deprive the trainees of food. And a lot of people just can't hack it. You know, it's just it's a terribly trying experience for them to go without food, because they've never gone without food before. And, you know, I belong to these intermittent fasting groups on Facebook, and you see people who are like toughing it out for their first, you know, their first 16-hour fast. And, you know, and like, you know, we Jews have a lot of practice with this. But, you know, all of this is really an illustration of Seneca's point, where you put yourself into a situation of lack or of deficiency, and you face the situation and you ask yourself, is this the condition that I feared? And most of the time you will find that it is not what you feared. You know, you panicked about the fact that I'm not going to have food, and then you face the situation and the world doesn't end. Now I say that the reason why I'm making an episode about this today, in addition to just talking about my experience, is that on Tisha B'Av, we read an interesting Gemara. So this is in the famous Kamsa Bar Kamsa Gemara, which is a very, very long Gemara in Gittin. And I want to read from the episode about the woman named, Marta Bas Baisos. Okay. And I'm going to actually just read, just for the sake of expediency, I'm going to read from the Davidson translation, the Koran translation on Al HaTorah, without reading the Aramaic here. So, and I'm going to read it with all of the explanatory words added in. Okay, so it's talking, the scenario is talking about when Jerusalem was in a state of famine during the era of the Second Temple, and leading up to its destruction. So it says, with regard to this famine, it is related that Marta Bas Baisos was one of the wealthy women of Jerusalem. She sent out her agent and said to him, go bring me fine flour. Okay, so again, the situation is that the city is facing a famine. So she sends her servant, says, go bring me fine flour. By the time he went, the fine flour was already sold. He came back and said to her, there is no fine flour, but there is ordinary flour. She said to him, go then and bring me ordinary flour. By the time he went, the ordinary flour was also sold. He came and said to her, there is no ordinary flour, but there is coarse flour. She said to him, go then and bring me coarse flour. By the time he went, the coarse flour was already sold. He came and said to her, there is no coarse flour, but there is barley flour. She said to him, go then and bring me barley flour. But once again, by the time he went, the barley flour was also sold. She had just removed her shoes, but she said, I will go out myself and see if I can find something to eat. She stepped on some dung, which stuck to her foot, and, overcome by disgust, she died. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai read concerning her, meaning about her, a verse found in the section of the Torah listing the curses that will befall Israel. This is in Devarim, Deuteronomy 28:56. Quote, the tender and delicate woman among you who would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground. Okay, so in other words, you want me to look at the actual pasuk for one second. Okay, yeah, so the full pasuk says, "The tender and delicate woman among you who had never tried to set the sole of her foot on the ground because of delicacy and tenderness will turn selfish against the husband of her bosom and against her son and daughter." And it goes on to describe more horrific things. Okay, so we were analyzing this on Tisha B'Av, and we didn't arrive at a final formulation, but we said that, you read this story, and like there's a famine going on, right? And she is telling her servant to fetch her the best flour, okay? And the best flour is not there. And then he comes back, and she says, "Okay, get the next best flour." And this repeats itself. So you're looking at this woman, and she is, I mean, she's completely removed from reality. I mean, like it's a famine. Like she should get whatever's available, right? I mean, the illusion that she can, you see that she's caught up on having she. You only the best for Marta, right? That she must have the best, and one of the things we commented on is like, if you were in the servant's position, wouldn't you just go and buy whatever flour there is and then say, "I'm sorry, ma'am, this is the best that I can get." But it must be that this woman was so used to getting her way and so used to ordering her servants around that perhaps the servant would not even think to go against his mistress's wishes. Like I it's much makes much more sense to lay the blame on Marta rather than on her servant, and say that this was just her normal way, that she was so insistent on getting the best. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because Marta is someone who could not do what Seneca was describing. She had like her own standards of living, and the thought of going from fine flour to barley flour was unthinkable to her. Like she could only when forced to confront the reality that there's no fine flour, she could go one level down, to the next, to the regular flour, right? But she couldn't go all the way down. And we see that when she finally like had to confront, she had to set foot on her own into the world, and she stepped in dung. That was just too much for her, and she died. I mean, it was too overwhelming for her psyche. So what Seneca is suggesting is not that we engage in asceticism for the sake of asceticism, but that we expose ourselves gradually to simulations of situations of lack and distress in order to dissolve the irrational fears that surround these states and prepare ourselves, it's an experiential premeditatio malorum where we are thinking of the bad things that could happen to us and not only preparing for them mentally, but actually like simulating them to a certain degree. And again, in Judaism, we have this experience, just from the halakhic system itself, where we deprive ourselves of food for 25 hours, 2 times a year on Tisha B'Av and on Yom Kippur. So we do get practice with this. But there's an interesting thing, which is that the Gemara goes on and says that there's another theory about how she died. So it says, "There are those who say that she did not step on dung, but rather she ate a fig of Rabbi Tzadok and became disgusted and died. What are these figs? Rabbi Tzadok observed fasts for 40 years, praying that Jerusalem would not be destroyed. He became so emaciated from fasting that when he would eat something, it was visible from outside of his body. And when he would eat after the fast, they would bring him figs, and he would suck out the liquid and cast the rest away. It was one such fig that Marta Bas Baisos found, and that caused her death." Okay, so in other words, according to this interpretation, she didn't die by stepping in dung. She died because she ate one of these like squeezed out figs that Rabbi Tzadok had eaten. Okay, so the question is, what's up with that? Like, what idea are the sages trying to get across by saying that that's what killed her? So again, we were learning this. This is at the end of our learning session, our close to 4 hour learning session on Tisha B'Av afternoon. We didn't get a chance to finish the idea, but we came up with a theory that went something like this. This whole Gemara really begins with a pasuk in Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, which says, "Ashrei Adam mefached tamid, umakshe libo yipol bara'a," which means, "Praiseworthy slash happy is the man who is constantly apprehensive, but one who hardens his heart will fall into harm." Okay, and this is in Proverbs 28:14, Mishlei 28:14. This is the Gemara that frames the entire thing. So the basic idea of the pasuk is that we live in a world governed by rational lawfulness and cause and effect that we are subject to, right? That's God's will. And if you recognize that, then you will be apprehensive, not in a state of cowering fear, but you will think through all your decisions before you make them to try to figure out what the consequences could be, and so you can maximize your chances of getting the results that you want. If you do that consistently, that's tamid, all the time, then you'll live a life that is both praiseworthy and happy. But if you sense that this is the world you live in, okay, which all of us sense that this is the world we live in, and then you harden your heart to that, and you just kind of tell yourself, oh, this is not going to happen to me. Everything's going to be okay. You know, it'll work out for me. Like, yeah, this happens to other people, but it's not going to happen to me. So then you will inevitably fall into harm. And you'll fall into harm in two ways. One is that you will ultimately make a decision that gives you the bad consequences. But furthermore, you're going to be in a constant state of conflict because part of you recognizes that reality is not going to go your way. And you're going to have to expend a tremendous amount of energy denying that in order to uphold this fantasy world that you live in. And so you're going to be in a state of distress as well, whereas the guy in the first half of the pasuk is going to be in a state of, he's accepting reality. He's accepting that things could go wrong, and he's not trying to deny anything. So in other words, it turns out that the reason why the first half says Ashrei, that the person is happy and praiseworthy, is that he won't be denying reality, and because he doesn't deny reality, he'll make better decisions which end up with a net benefit for him and avoiding harmful consequences. Whereas the person in the second half who makes their heart stubborn is going to expend a tremendous amount of energy denying reality, be in a constant state of conflict, and that will lead them to make bad decisions which will actually lead to their harm. Okay, so this is really this pasuk is what the sages used to kick off all these gemaras about the destruction of the second base of Mikdash. And, you know, we were coming up with a theory where each of these gemaras reflects this pasuk. And that's what our theory was about Marta Bar Baisos and Rabbi Tzadok, that these are two opposites. Okay, so on the one hand, you have Marta who refuses to believe that there's no fine flour. And then when she's confronted with that, she refuses to believe that there's no ordinary flour, et cetera, et cetera. And she's so stuck. She's so stuck in this mode of maksha libo, of being stubborn, that and refusing to accept that things could go in a way where it undermines the status quo that she's been used to, you know, her pampered status quo. She just can't face it. Okay. So that's her. And then you have Rabbi Tzadok, who 40 years before the destruction of the Beis Mikdash, he saw that this is something that might happen. And I forgot who we read. One of the commentaries said that what happened 40 years ago, why did he start this fast 40 years ago? Because that's when the Sanhedrin was disbanded, or when it was exiled. And so he knew that there was a possibility that Jerusalem would be destroyed. And so he was preparing, you know, talk about premeditatio malorum. He was preparing for this inevitability, realizing that we could lose everything. And he was subjecting himself to a fast. You know, he was the opposite of pampered. He barely ate anything, to the point where he was almost starving to death. And he was able to be contented with just the juice from a fig. So you have these two polar opposites here, right? And this, we theorize, is the idea that, like, you know, I don't know if I want to use the word symbolically, but like, the fig that sustained Rabbi Tzadok is what killed Marta. In other words, the thing that was emblematic of his virtue, the fact that he was able to recognize that the entire status quo that you're used to could totally collapse, and we have to act now and do teshuva and do self, introspection and rehabilitate ourselves as a nation. You know, he was preparing for that ahead of time, realizing that things could go bad. She was on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, in denial of that, and she couldn't handle it, and that's what killed her. So this is something that Tisha B'Av, I guess, you know, it's funny. I didn't think that this episode was going to be about Tisha B'Av, but I guess we ended up there now, that Tisha B'Av does prepare us for the fact that things could go south really fast in a really bad way. You know, it'd be very, very nice to just, think that you know, the Jewish people will go on. In fact, someone in our learning group said, you know, a lot of Jews, let's say in America, think that, okay, we'll live out our prosperous life in America until Mashiach comes, until the Messianic era, and then we'll go to Israel and everything will be great. You know, it's very hard for us in exile to think about the fact that things could go horribly wrong here and we can have another Holocaust. Or, you know, for those in Israel, I mean, I think there's a lot of people in Israel who think there's no way that God could allow us to lose Israel again. You know, Says who? Says who? I mean, we can lose Israel again. There could be terrible deaths, horrible terrorist attacks, wars, etc. And we can even in the prophecies about the Emos Mashiach, about the Messianic era, there's going to be tremendous wars and lots of deaths and losses. So you could be so this is really the path in front of us. You could be a Marta. Sorry, you could be a Rabbi Tzadok who is constantly practicing this recognition intellectually and experientially that the status quo could totally change and we could be in a dire situation in an instant, and we can prepare ourselves for that. Or you could be the Marta who, even when reality is collapsing around her, refuses to acknowledge it. And fasting is something that prepares us for this. Okay. Wow, this is already a long episode, but I'm gonna go on because I wanna express these thoughts while they're fresh. Switching gears for a second, I mentioned that there is a custom to, so okay, the basic halacha, at least for Ashkenazim, is when the fast of Tisha B'Av is over, then we continue observing the stringencies of prior to Tisha B'Av until the next morning. And so you don't immediately go from the break fast into a restriction-free mode. And that's because on a normal year, then we observe morning into the 10th day of Av, because even though the fire was set on the 9th, the Beis HaMikdash continued burning into the 10th, and so we observe partial morning on the 10th. And then even on a year like this, where Tisha B'Av is pushed off, and we observe the fast of Tisha B'Av on the 10th of Av, even then, you don't just go and end the fast and then be in a restriction-free zone. We still continue to refrain from eating meat and wine on the night of the 10th because of the Avelus Shel Yom, because of the morning of the day. So when I did my last year, when I did my fast, my 48-hour fast into the from the 9th into the entire day of the 10th, there was this interesting feeling where most other people are going about their business and eventually not observing any restrictions anymore. And here I am continuing my fast. And there is a recognition of the fact that what are we doing? We're mourning the destruction of the Beis Mikdash and Yerushalayim and our exile. And even though our commemoration of that does come to an end, the tzara, the catastrophe itself, did not come to an end. Like we don't just, when we're doing our commemoration, we have the luxury of ending it and just going back to our normal lives. But in reality, we don't. We are still in exile, and this is why we have year-round all these, Zecher LeChurban practices, all these commemorations of the destruction, that we don't allow ourselves to slip into this mentality where everything is just normal. And so I don't know. I think it's very easy for us to, when we break the fast and then immediately dive into the food, it's very easy to just kind of like push all of the Tisha B'Av ideational content out of our minds. But really, the halacha is designed to get us to cling to that and realize that no, the tragedy is ongoing. And yes, we can't make you in a constant state of mourning for the Beis Mikdash on this level of intensity, but you also can't just leave it behind. And so that's something that I feel, not again, not this year, but that I feel in general, or that I, sorry, not that I feel in general, that I felt last year when I did this 48-hour fast. So that's just another thought. One more thought here. This is funny. So this is from Epictetus. I think I've also talked about this. I can't remember in what context. Epictetus in the handbook, in the Enchiridion chapter 50. So he's talking about the teachings in the handbook, and he says, "Hold fast to the things herein proposed as if they were laws, as if it would be sacrilegious to transgress them." Okay, so that's talking about all the Stoic principles, and he's saying basically like view it as though these are laws and don't violate them. Okay, now the funny thing is that they're not laws, right? I mean, they're Stoic principles that a person voluntarily aligns themselves with. So I'm finding an interesting experience here because, I'm coming out of a 25-hour fast that is mandated by halacha, and then going into another 23 hours of an optional fast. And it's funny because in halacha, then, you can't, I mean, of course you could choose to violate halacha whenever you want, but like, we don't choose when the fast starts and when it ends, right? I mean, legally speaking, halakhically speaking, like the fast started at what was it? 8:35, I think. In Seattle, 8:35, and then ended at like 9:27, right? So like there is this, you know, towards the end of the fast, you know, we're like waiting, waiting, waiting. Okay, 9:27. Okay, now let's make Havdalah and then we'll eat, right? Today in my voluntary fast, it's funny because, you know, I'm treating the fast as being, you know, I want to fast for 48 hours. And I started fasting, the last time I ate was on Shabbos afternoon at 8:15. So like in my mind, the fast ends today, Monday at 8:15. But there's no halacha that is telling me to stick to that time. In other words, if I wanted to, I could eat at 8:10. I could eat at 7:10. I could eat right now, you know? And it is just, this is not a new insight, but it never ceases to amaze me how much of a boon it is to have halacha backing up all these practices of perfection, where, you know, because of the halachic system, because this is a legal reality, then we can like, you know, kick back, not kick back, we can rely on the framework of the law to support us and not have to make it a pure exercise of willpower. I'm sure I've talked about this before, but, you know, there are people I know who smoke cigarettes, and at least I've heard several of them say that on Shabbos, when they can't smoke, they have no trouble controlling themselves. But as soon as Shabbos is over, then they immediately feel like they have to have a cigarette. And it's amazing that the law has that power to be able to actually like modify our desires. And I'm just experiencing that in a very visceral way right now, because I can eat whenever I want right now without violating halacha. So easy for Epictetus to say, hold fast to these principles as if they were laws, but as if they are laws is not at all equivalent to actually being laws. You know, the two are very, very different from a psychological standpoint. And that's why one of the many, 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 many reasons why I'm thankful to have halacha to force me to adhere to these practices that develop me as a human being instead of doing them on a purely voluntaristic basis like the Stoics did. Okay, that was a long episode. That's, I think, all I have to say. I hope I'm not forgetting anything. But yeah, that's all I have to say for now. If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/Rabbi Schneeweiss. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweiss Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is at Matt-Schneeweiss, and my Zelle and PayPal are MattSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor a day's or a week's worth of content, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at RabbiSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening, thank you to my readers for reading, and thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone. And oh, look, it is now 5:15, which means I have exactly 3 hours until my 48-hour fast ends. Hopefully it ends well. Okay. All right. Until next time.